All right, it's time for us to begin. If you'll go ahead and open your Bibles, Luke chapter 7. We've moved on from the Sermon on the Mount. I was thinking about this, however long it took Jesus to speak those words in Matthew chapters 5, 6, and 7. And perhaps there were other words that were with it. We talked about how that their reaction was one of amazement, that they had never heard teaching like that before. And we talked about how that, again, Jesus requires of us that we actually do something with that they respond, that they act upon the things that he taught them. But I thought about how that perhaps the day after, perhaps you'd been in that audience at that time, and you'd heard Jesus preach this sermon, and you thought to yourself, again, I need to do something with that. How blessed are we, again, to have the written word, so that, again, as Peter wrote, that we can be stirred up by way of reminder. The ability to, again, go back and reread it and think about it and understand what it is that we need to do with it. And hopefully those who, again, heard it that day, perhaps Jesus preached it again. Perhaps they had a chance to remind ourselves. But we are so blessed to read the words of Jesus, to read what he taught, to read what he did, and to be able to go back and read it again. So that, again, we might come to a point where it's part of our memory, part of our understanding. We're able to call these things to mind, but again, that we're able to do them and actually implement them in our lives. So we're going to move on in our studies. We studied the life of Christ after he came down from this mountain and some of the other things that he did and some of the lessons that he taught. And we'll do that in Luke chapter 7. All right, so to begin our study tonight, if I can get someone to go ahead and read the context in Luke chapter 7 and verses 1 through 10.
Luke 7, 1 through 10. After he had ended all his sayings in the ears of the people, he entered into Capernaum. A certain centurion servant, who was dear unto him, was sick and at the point of death. When he heard concerning Jesus, he sent unto him elders of the Jews, asking him that he would come and save his servant. And they, when they came to Jesus, besought him earnestly, saying, He is worthy that thou shouldst do this for him, for he loveth our nation, and himself built us our synagogue. And Jesus went with them, and when he was now far from the house, the centurion sent friends to him, saying unto him, Lord, trouble not thyself, for I am not worthy that thou shouldst come under my roof. Wherefore neither thought I myself worthy to come unto thee, but say the word, and my servant shall be healed. For I also am a man under authority, set under authority, having under myself soldiers. I say to this one, go, and he goeth, and to another, come, and he cometh. And to my servant, do this, and he doeth it. And when Jesus heard these things, he marveled at him, and turned and said unto the multitude that followed him, I say to you, I have not found so great faith, no, not in Israel. And they that were sent, returning to the house, found the servant whole.
All right. So again, we read in verse 1 that he had completed all of his discourse. That is what we had studied in Matthew chapter 5, 6, and 7. And he is, as it were, coming down from that mountain. And by the way, I did talk with Mickey and Jim about this. This is a picture from the port of Tiberias, which we will see in just a moment. It's actually on the west coast of the Sea of Galilee. But we think of, again, the fishing trade that Peter and Andrew and James and John left behind. What I read was this was one of the more common fish that the fishermen would catch. And obviously, as you can see, it's a large fish. And we talked about how that, this was part of the miracle, the feeding of the 5,000. Somehow in my mind, I always pictured a real small fish. But nonetheless, even with these huge fish, it indeed a miracle. But anyway, just to help us picture in our minds, and we'll have some other pictures later on, of life around the Sea of Galilee. But we read here in Luke chapter 7, beginning in verse 1, that again, following the Sermon on the Mount, when he had come down from the mountain in the city of Capernaum. But it's interesting, we've read about the city of Capernaum before. Let's remember, this is in fact where was Jesus born?
Bethlehem.
Where was he raised?
Bethlehem.
But you know where he considered home?
Capernaum. So if someone could read Mark chapter 4, I'm sorry, Matthew chapter 4, verses 12 and 13. Anybody have that? David?
Matthew chapter 4, verses 12 through 13. Now when Jesus heard that John had been taken into custody, he withdrew into Galilee, and leaving Nazareth, he came and settled in Capernaum, which is by the sea, in the region of Zebulun and Naphtali.
So again, when he talked about, okay, I was born in Oregon, but I settled in Lancaster. Again, we talk about the fact that that's where I took up home. It may not be my original home, but that's where I settled. And we see here that Jesus indeed settled in the city of Capernaum. And if you go to Mark chapter 2, and in verse 1, there we read, when he had come back to Capernaum several days afterwards, it was heard that he was at home. Again, this is where he considered a home to be. And so this is something very familiar to Jesus. It was a city in which Jesus did a lot of teaching. He taught in the synagogue. But if I could get somebody to read verse 21 of Mark chapter 1. You have that. Carolyn?
Mark 1:21. They went into Capernaum, and immediately on the Sabbath he entered the synagogue and began to teach.
And in verse 22 also?
They were amazed at his teaching, for he was teaching them as one having authority and not as the scribes.
Okay, so they observed, as he taught in the synagogue in Capernaum, they observed what the audience during the Sermon on the Mount observed. He taught as one having authority. If I can get someone then to read Luke chapter 4, verses 31 through 38.
Jim?
And he went down to Capernaum, city of Galilee, and he was teaching them on the Sabbath. And they were astonished at his teaching, for his word possessed authority. And in the synagogue there was a man who had the spirit of an unclean demon, and he cried out in a loud voice, "Ha, what have you to do with us, Jesus of Nazareth? Have you come to destroy us? I know who you are, the Holy One of God." But Jesus rebuked him, saying, "Be silent, and come out of him." And when the demon had thrown him down in the midst, he came out of him, having done him no harm. And they were all amazed and said to one another, "What is this word? For with authority and power he commanded the unclean spirits to come out of him." And reports about him went out into every place in the surrounding region. And he arose and left the synagogue and entered Simon's house. Now Simon's mother-in-law was ill with high fever, and they appeared to him on her behalf.
All right, so a couple of other things about that we'll point out in just a moment. But again, Capernaum was where he taught in the synagogue often. They heard him preach and teach. And the interesting point is, those who knew the Old Testament scriptures, it was prophesied of the Messiah that he would do his preaching and teaching in this area. That he would be in this land. If I can get somebody to read then Mark 4, 13 through 16. We left off in Mark chapter 4, verse 12, but let's go back to Mark chapter 4 and read 13 through 16. Mickey?
Mark 4, 13 again. And he saith unto them, "Know ye not this parable? How ye know all the parables?" The sower.
Mickey?
That's correct.
Mark, Matthew 4?
Oh, Mark 4.
I said Mark. I apologize. Matthew 4.
It took me a while to work that.
Yeah, it is.
Mark 4, yes. Okay, we were looking at Mark 4, beginning at verse...
Matthew 4, beginning at verse 13.
Leaving Nazareth, came and dwelt in Capernaum, which is by the sea, the borders of Zebulun and Naphtali, that it might be fulfilled which was spoken through Isaiah the prophet, saying, "The land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali, toward the sea beyond the Jordan, Galilee of the Gentiles. The people that sat in the darkness saw a great light, and to them that sat in the region in the shadow of death, to them."
The interesting thing is, again, I don't, Mickey, can you give like a quick... Galilee, where this is taking place, again, who resides there?
Well, we might say Galileans.
Right.
Okay. You're thinking the various tribes that settled in that area?
Right.
And look at the map.
Here we're talking about the land of Zebulun
and Naphtali.
Now, is this necessarily where you would think as a Jew that someone who would teach would concentrate their efforts? You know, the scribes and the Pharisees would say, yeah, it's Capernaum where I'd focus my efforts to teach and preach. No, you'd focus in Jerusalem. You'd focus where, again, the Sanhedrin Council was. But again, according to prophecy, it was said that the Messiah would focus in this part in terms of his preaching and his teaching in the land of Capernaum. And again, contrary to perhaps human wisdom, this is what God said would take place.
Nick? Do you think the reason for that was, as Jesus had stated, that a prophet is not without honor except in his own country? Seemed like he was received up in the northern areas.
He was received more, but we're also going to point out something about Capernaum, how that even a lot of people in this area should have believed, there should have been more belief than there was. Because one thing we're going to point out is that not only did he teach a lot in the synagogue in Capernaum, he did a lot of miracles. And we've read some of these already, how that, again, he evidenced who he was. And yet, despite the fact that, as Mick said, I mean, there were a lot of people who believed, but there was a lot of unbelief. And we're going to point out that in just a moment, how Jesus rebuked those in the city of Capernaum for that. But one of the things we've read already from Mark chapter 4 was, who else lived here? We read that he went into whose house?
Peter's
house, and he healed his mother-in-law. So again, we know that Peter, Andrew, James, and John were from this area. This was their home, where they came from. And indeed, many miracles were performed there, and we're going to cite some of those a little bit later.
Roughly, what would be the distance from Nazareth to Capernaum?
Just one moment. We'll come to a map, and I think we'll be able to see that. I'm thinking, because I did note, after Capernaum, he goes down to Nain, I believe that was 20-something miles. I think Nazareth is a little bit more than that. So we'll see in just a moment. So, again, as I pointed out, one of the interesting things about this is he performed a lot of miracles. Yet there were a lot of people who saw the same miracles. Oh, and the other thing is the reference we didn't read, John chapter 6. And that whole discussion in John chapter 6, that's where he talks about himself being what? The bread of life, and he who partakes of me. And what else is said about those in John 6 who heard the teaching about Jesus being the bread of life and he who eats my flesh and drinks my blood? What is said of those who heard that sermon there in John chapter 6? They found it hard, and that took place in Capernaum. That whole sermon in John chapter 6 took place there, and it was some of the people there who listened to that who said, that's tough. That's a hard statement, and they left him. Again, they abandoned their faith there in Capernaum. Noah, do you have your hand up?
He said he was the prophet.
Yeah. So, look, if you will, at Matthew chapter 11 regarding Capernaum. With everything that he did, and again, we'll be talking about some of the miracles, and we've already read some of them. But in Matthew chapter 11, let's begin reading in verse 20. Then he began to denounce the cities in which most of his miracles were done, because they did not repent. Woe to you, Chorazin! Woe to you, Bethsaida! For if the miracles had occurred in Tyre and Sidon, which occurred in you, they would have repented long ago in sackcloth and ashes. Nevertheless, I say to you, it will be more tolerable for Tyre and Sidon in the day of judgment than for you. And you, Capernaum, will not be exalted to heaven, will you? You will descend to Hades, for if the miracles had occurred in Sodom, which occurred in you, it would have remained to this day. Nevertheless, I say to you that it will be more tolerable for the land of Sodom in the day of judgment than for you.
Jesus held these people accountable. He said, I performed a lot of miracles among you, and a lot of you did not believe. There was a lot of disbelief, even though he had done so many things. And he said, you know, there were a lot of other people who didn't have these miracles performed. But he says, I know some of those cities would have repented. So it's interesting, again, how much time he spent there and how much teaching was done and how many miracles were performed. And yet there were so many who, again, just would not believe.
Well, you look at the very first thing that Mickey read tonight, what about the centurion? Did he actually see Jesus do miracles or just hear about him?
Yeah, really.
But yet he had greater faith than Israel.
Absolutely. So again, here we see on the map, and here is Capernaum. So here is Nazareth. Like I said, Nain is about 20 to 25 miles, so I guess Nazareth would be about the same, it looks like. I thought it was a little bit further away. But if you think about a 20 to 25 mile walk, that's a good day's hike, isn't it? I mean, if you can walk, say, 3 miles an hour, that would take you all day, you know, to walk 25 miles. All right, so he went to Capernaum there on the northern side of the Sea of Galilee. Just a couple more things about the city, as Jesus kind of, as it were, prophesied and said. You can go to where Capernaum was, and there's not a lot left. There's not much there. And what you see here is a synagogue that was built after Jesus was there. But on the very bottom, this is like, I believe, from the 5th century, this part up. But you see this dark part down here. That perhaps is the remains of what was there when Jesus actually preached. That black portion called basalt, I think it was made out of. And here's a little bit closer picture. So this is what they believe is actually the foundation of the synagogue that was there when Jesus would have taught in their synagogue. The rest of it would have been from about the 5th century. We showed this last week. This perhaps would have been towards where the Sermon on the Mount was. And again, down there, down here is where Capernaum and the remains would have been. And then real quickly, one other picture. This is the area from an aerial point of view with the Sea of Galilee, obviously, in the background. All right, so he comes into this city of Capernaum, where he had taught a lot. He had performed a lot of miracles. And again, he later condemned them for their lack of belief. And we read here that he meets... Now, we need to tie in Matthew chapter 8 with Luke chapter 7. So if you go back to Matthew chapter 8, where the same events are discussed, it says in verse 5 in Matthew 8, and when Jesus entered Capernaum, a centurion came to him imploring him. Now, do you remember, if you flip back to Luke chapter 7, as Mickey read it, he went to Capernaum, verse 1, and the centurion's slave, who was highly regarded by him, was sick and about to die. And when he heard about Jesus, he sent some Jewish elders asking him to come and to save the life of the slave. Now, again, is this a irreconcilable difference? Or, again, if someone in authority sends people on his behalf, again, are you, in essence, sending yourself? As it were, when God sends apostles, they carry the word of God. And so I believe it's simply the case that, again, this centurion sent some Jewish elders. And again, as Matthew records it, they represented this centurion when they came to him. But when we think about centurions, is he the only centurion that we read about in the scriptures? Anybody else think of another one?
Acts chapter
10. I'm sorry?
Acts chapter 10.
Okay. Acts chapter who named?
Cornelius.
Cornelius, yeah. Yeah, we have Cornelius. Anybody else think of another reference to a centurion, Chris?
Acts 20. When Jesus first got arrested?
Yes.
And he saved him from the law?
Yes. Yeah, so as it were, his protector, and as it were, saved his life. And there's one other that I can think of in the scriptures. Just before Jesus died at the cross in Mark chapter 15. So we read about at the cross, Mark chapter 15, Cornelius in Acts chapter 10, and Chris, good job in terms of Acts chapter 22. Again, the protection that was provided to Paul. Interestingly enough, all three times that we read about centurions in the scriptures, would you say that they were upstanding and good people, if we can use that term? I'm sorry?
The ones that are mentioned, absolutely.
No, but that's all we can say is that the three examples, all three of them, again, the one at the cross, Cornelius, and the one who protected Paul's life, seem to be upstanding men. When you think about, again, let's talk about what were centurions. They were soldiers.
But they were over soldiers.
Did they? In the overall scheme of things, again, as we know, governments and military, you have a hierarchy, right? I mean, you have the general, and then all the different levels down to the private, so to speak. Just in general, where did centurions fit in there? Were they at the top of the heap, as it were? Noah?
Okay, so there were 100 soldiers.
Okay, right. So you see in the word centurion, that word century, which we get the word 100 from. So yeah, they had about 100 men underneath them. But did they also have, again, were they the top dog? No. And in fact, again, just looking at you may not be able to read that, but just in terms of the hierarchy, you started with legions, okay? And there were six of those. And under those, the legion was subdivided into 10 cohorts or bands, okay? So you have that level. And those bands or cohorts into three maniples, and the maniples into two centuries, again, containing 100 originally, and then subsequently 50 to 100 men. Thus, there were 60 centuries in a legion. So how many men in a legion? About 6,000. Okay? So again, as a centurion, you had 100 people underneath you. That's a lot of responsibility. Again, and you have that's a big charge. But you're also, as a centurion, how many layers above you do you have? You got three layers above you. So we're going to get to the point later on, does the centurion know how to give orders?
Yes.
Yeah. If you're going to, again, lead men, you've got to have some structure. And I think about, again, why perhaps we have three examples of centurions who were good men. How could you be a good centurion and not have some structure to your life and not have some semblance of order to what you do? But also, as a centurion, you're following the orders of other people. You understand there's others who have authority over you, whether it be, again, the maniples, the cohorts, the legions. Those who served in that capacity had authority over you. So we keep this in mind as we go forward about the centurion. He understood that he could give orders to the 100 men under him. And they needed to do that. But he also understood that as a centurion, he was going to direct those 100 men in response to the orders that he received from those who were above him. And I think most of us understand that. In a work environment, we have somebody who is over us. We may have other people that we direct. But we learn that aspect of authority. And those of you who have been in the military before, you perhaps learn that they are better than anywhere else in terms of this aspect of, again, authority and giving direction and the need to follow it. So we have the centurion. He sends these Jewish elders, and he sends them to Jesus because it says in Luke chapter 7 and verse 3, having heard about Jesus. And so somebody made the point,
again, had he perhaps listened to him? I don't know, but it says he heard about Jesus. Well, we pointed out that Jesus, that was his home there in Capernaum. What might if he heard about Jesus? We've read some of the things about him teaching in the synagogues, but notice in Luke chapter 4 and in verse 14, and we read this verse already, but let's just note it again. Luke chapter 4 and verse 14, and Jesus returned to Galilee in the power of the Spirit, and news about him spread through all the surrounding district. What does it mean that he returned to Galilee in the power of the Spirit? What's that talking about?
Well, he had just been tempted by Satan right previously,
okay.
And now he's going back home, so he's filled with the Spirit.
Okay. And indeed, by the Spirit, he was performing these miracles. But again, as Lynn pointed out, here in Luke chapter 4 and verse 14, where are we in the timeline of his ministry? At the very beginning. I mean, he had just finished the temptations and was following these temptations that he began to preach. And he began to do so in Galilee through the power of the Spirit. And news about him spread to the surrounding district. Word got out about what Jesus was doing, what he was preaching, and the miracles he was performing. News spread. And you think, how could they spread the news without texting? without newspapers? But how did the news spread?
By word of mouth.
By word of mouth. People talked. They talked about what he did. If you drop down in Luke chapter 4 to verse 31, again, we read from there earlier, Luke chapter 4, and in verse 31, again, it says that he came down to Capernaum, a city of Galilee, and he was teaching them on the Sabbath. And again, they were amazed at his teaching. Drop down to verse 37. And the report about him was spreading into every locality in the surrounding district. Again, he was performing these miracles. He was casting out the unclean demons. And he was preaching, and it says the report about him was spreading into every locality. It was going everywhere. Word was spreading. Again, as we said, people talk. And again, some of the things that Jesus performed, especially right after this, amazed people. And there was great fear sometimes. And then finally, in John chapter 4, one other thing in terms of what this centurion would have heard about. John chapter 4, beginning in verse 46. If I can get someone to read verse 46 through 54. I'm sorry? John. John 4, 46 through 54. Thank you, Jenny.
So he came again to Cana in Galilee, where he had made the water wine. And at Capernaum there was an official whose son was ill. When this man heard that Jesus had come from Judea to Galilee, he went to him and asked him to come down and heal his son, for he was at the point of death. So Jesus said to him, "Unless you see signs and wonders, you will not believe." The official said to him, "Sir, come down before my child dies." Jesus said to him, "Go, your son will live." The man believed the word that Jesus spoke to him and went on his way. As he was going down, his servants met him and told him that his son was recovering. So he asked them the hour when he began to get better. And they said to him, "Yesterday at the seventh hour the fever left him." The father knew that was the hour when Jesus had said to him, "Your son will live." And he himself believed, and all his household. This was now the second sign that Jesus did when he had come from Judea to Galilee.
All right, so we read here about, and we studied this already, this has already happened, that he came to Cana of Galilee, and when he was in Cana of Galilee, where he had made the water into wine, it says there was a royal official whose son was sick at Capernaum. And again, he comes to there to Cana of Galilee, and it's there that Jesus again heals this son who's back in Capernaum. Any similarities between this and what we read about here in Luke chapter 7? Now here in John chapter 4, it's a man's son. Who are we reading about here in Luke chapter 7? A centurion's servant. But in both cases, there is someone who is healed. And he's healed by Jesus physically standing over him? No. He's not even there.
But again, in Capernaum, it's this official who had his son healed by Jesus, who was not even there. Again, the centurion who lived in Capernaum, think he heard about that? Think he understood that there was an official there in Capernaum whose son was miraculously healed by somebody who was not even there? Now, we talked about the fact that there were many in Capernaum who saw what Jesus did and did not believe. But here's a centurion who heard about Jesus. He was told by somebody else, perhaps it was his royal official, who told him, my son was sick, and Jesus wasn't even here, and I sent for him, and he healed him. Now the centurion, again, hears that Jesus is there. He had heard about Jesus. A lot had been said about him. The word had spread throughout Capernaum and all that district. And we pointed out that in Luke chapter 7, and Luke records that again, the centurion sent somebody on his behalf, didn't he? And who did he send? Jewish elders. The centurion, is he a Jew?
No.
He's a Roman. He sent a Roman sends Jewish elders to plead for him. Interesting. Why would a Gentile army official send Jewish leaders to request this of Jesus? And why would these Jewish elders do this for a Roman? Why, first of all, why would the centurion decide to send Jewish elders to Jesus?
Jesus was Jewish. Yeah. Perhaps he felt they could have more
sway. What, and that would make sense, too. Does that perhaps show some wisdom on the centurion's part? That to understand as a Roman, I perhaps may not be received as well as if I have some Jewish elders go on my behalf? But why would the Jewish elders do this for him?
Well, it says that he was a good man and he helped him build their temple.
Okay. All right.
Or sanctuary.
So, again, they have their reasons. Again, but what does it say about the character of the centurion? What type of relationship did he have with the Jewish elders? Evidently a good one. He was someone who was respected by the Jewish elders there in Capernaum. Interestingly enough, how did Jesus typically characterize the rulers of the Gentiles in Matthew chapter 25? How did he typically, what was said about the rulers of the Gentiles there in that verse? What did they typically like to do? How were they, how did they deal with the authority that they had? Yeah. He talked about the fact that the rulers of the Gentiles lorded over them. As he looked upon these rulers, he said, normally they like to, again, beat you into submission. But that's not what we see here with this centurion. And in fact, it would be perhaps one thing if you said this about the centurion and it was his son that was sick. But who is sick? One of his servants. That he cares about them that much. So was this man different from what Jesus perhaps encountered? Well, he was, and he noted that later on. Very much so. And in fact, he not only compares the centurion to other, again, Roman rulers, he compares this centurion to who? To everybody that he's met, including, interestingly enough, the Jewish elders. He's comparing his faith to everybody that he's met. Is this man different? Yes, he is. So the Jewish elders then came to Jesus, and what is it that Luke records that they did on behalf of the centurion? In verse 4, what is it said that they came and did?
Implored him.
Implored him. You ever implored anybody, Noah? Yeah. I'm sure you have. What do you do when you implore somebody?
Praise them.
I'm sorry?
Praise them.
Well, not so much praise, it's more you're desperate. It's a desperate plea. I mean, it's, you know, you're in a situation where, again, you needed help. And you needed that help, actually, now. And if you've ever been, like, stranded on the side of the road or something like that, well, you've got to have help.
And that's kind of what this idea of imploring is all about, is being desperate for help.
He's about to die, so it is desperate.
Exactly. And you get the understanding that you know, this is not just a cold that this servant has. Actually, it says he's nigh unto death. Okay? So the Jewish elders, they earnestly implored him. And what they're earnestly imploring him, the reason is, they're imploring Jesus, stating he is worthy for you to grant this to him. It's interesting, in this context, the word worthy is used a number of times, but it's not the same word all the time. Okay? So first of all, here in Luke chapter 7, verse 4, in which they say of the centurion that he is worthy. So they come to Jesus and they're like, his servant is sick and we want you to heal him, and we're begging and we're pleading because he is worthy. Now this word for worthy means to, I'm still talking about the word for earnestly implore, to beg, to entreat, to beseech. Okay, I apologize. So why did they deem him worthy? Okay, so they said he is worthy for you to do this. What do they say about him?
Because he loves the nation.
He loves the nation. And?
So, he's building. He was a big builder.
What's he done for us? He built our synagogue. So they come to Jesus and say, please do this for him because he is worthy. Well, this idea of worthy, it comes from the Greek word axios, which means deserving, befitting, one who has merited anything. What are these Jewish elders saying of this centurion about the favor that they're asking him to give to Jesus?
He's earned it.
Remember, there was there's an old commercial I remember back that said, he's earned it. But that's what they're saying about this centurion, isn't it? Aren't they? Okay, he's very kind to us. He's benevolent to us. He has helped our nation. Oh yeah, he built our synagogue for us. He is worthy for you to do this. It's befitting. He has merited this. He's earned it. You know, merit is what? It is something, you know, your merit, when you're a Boy Scout and you get a merit badge, that's what you've earned, right?
I find it interesting that this follows on the heels of Jesus on the Mount, where he has taught that if the soldiers bid you go 1 mile, you go two. They want your coat, you give them your cloak also. And so this was the relationship that was fairly typical for the Roman soldiers to carry out their responsibilities and duties of peacekeeping. But here's a man, much like Cornelius, who is described by those who know him as a righteous man, a man that's very benevolent. As we see Cornelius, who gave much alms to the people, that I think would be the people of Jews.
Yeah.
So he governed not with the iron fist.
No.
We're so
no.
Typical of this.
Absolutely. And they viewed that again as merit. He had earned the right of Jesus to perform this miracle. I find that interesting. That because of what they had done for him, and to his credit, that's, as Mickey pointed out, he was indeed a good leader. And again, he interacted well. But in Acts chapter 25, verse 11, this same word for worthy is used, and there Paul says, what? If I have done anything worthy of death. And by that he means if I have merited death, if there's anything that I've done to earn, you know, a capital punishment, I deserve not to die. We read also in 1 Timothy chapter 5 and verse 18, Paul tells Timothy the laborer is what? Worthy of his hire. He's merited. He's earned the wages. This is what, again, the Jewish elders come and say to Jesus, he has earned this. And we're not putting down what the centurion has done. I'm just pointing out the mindset of these Jewish elders. So this is how they saw, again, favor. Favor was to be earned.
And he had earned that. And that's, again, a wonderful relationship that he had had with the Jews there. But the question is, how do we see ourselves? How do we, again, that's part of the gospel, isn't it? That's part of the Sermon on the Mount that Jesus had not just talked about, because the very first beatitude was what? Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Does the poor in spirit, again, see himself as someone who has merited favor? Someone who earned the right for Jesus to, again, come and to live and to die? But we see ourselves as poor, as beggars, as someone who needs to plead. But it's just interesting, in Luke chapter 15, and in verse 19, we're reading about the prodigal son. And what is it that the prodigal son, when he finally came to himself, what did he say about himself in relation to his father? I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. I don't deserve that. And certainly he understood through his conduct it wasn't merited to be called his son anymore. But nonetheless, he pleaded to be his servant. He said, I don't deserve to be called your son. And when we think about Luke chapter 17, there Jesus talks, after being asked a question about how to increase our faith, Luke chapter 17, verse 10, he responds by saying, so you too, and he gives the example of a slave who goes out and does what his master has asked him to do. And verse 10 says, so you too, when you do all the things which are commanded, you say, we are unworthy slaves, we have done only that which we ought to have done. Again, the one who has great faith is going to be the one who simply does what Jesus asks us to do with the attitude that I'm an unworthy slave. I haven't earned, again, anything. I've only done what I ought to have done. And Genesis chapter 32 and verse 10, when we think about our lives today, we think all the ways in which God has blessed us. And that we're here right now, with clothes on our back and a home to go home to and food to eat. We've had our sins forgiven. We're members of the Lord's church. We're adopted children of God. You ever think about, again, where we are? And then in Genesis chapter 32 and verse 10, Jacob, as he is returning back to his brother Esau, says, I am unworthy of all the loving kindness and all the faithfulness which you have shown to your servant. His attitude was, I don't deserve. I haven't merited any of this. I am unworthy of your loving kindness, of all that you have blessed me with. David?
Well, I was just thinking how interesting it is. It's very interesting how we read about this centurion, and then if you look in Acts chapter 10 and read the first four verses about Cornelius,
yeah,
he was very much like this very centurion here.
Very much so.
God even said that your alms and your prayers have come up to me as a memorial,
yeah,
in the vision.
Yeah, but two very, by Jesus and by God, even in Acts chapter 10, very well respected for what they did. So again, we need to understand we are not worthy of all that has been done for us. So how do we apply Ephesians chapter 4 and verse 1, which says that we're to walk how? In a worthy manner. And Mick, I know you've heard people say, well, again, we're not worthy, you know. But how do we, if we're not worthy, how do we walk in a worthy manner? It's not worthy of ourselves, but he says in that passage, worthy of what? The gospel. Anybody have that ready?
It says, bearing with one another in love. I think, it says, walk worthy of the calling with which you are called, with all lowliness and gentleness,
right,
with long suffering, bearing with one another in love. It's a walk. It's a striving after.
Right.
It's a constant progression and helping others to do the same.
Right. Absolutely. It's speaking of the conduct, the way of life, and that we're worthy of the calling with which we have been called. How were we called?
By the gospel.
Again, we're to be walking worthy of the gospel. That means we respect, again, the gospel that called us. And we live according to that calling. So we need to understand that, again, though we're not worthy, we have an aspect of walking worthily, which doesn't mean that we earn anything. But it means it's appropriate for the gospel. Real quick, that's how the Jewish elders saw the centurion. How did the centurion see himself? I am not worthy for you to come under my roof. And here he is interesting, again, a different Greek word. This is different from what the Jewish elders had said. This word means sufficient, enough, adequate, competent. This centurion said of himself, I'm inadequate. I'm not sufficient for you to come under my roof. Do we ever have that feeling in life that we're not enough? That we're inadequate? That we're insufficient? And indeed, on our own spiritual merits, we're going to take a look at some passages that talk about the fact that indeed, our adequacy is not from ourselves. It's from God. And if you look up for next week, those passages, find those passages where Paul says and refers to the fact that our adequacy is from God. And it's the same Greek word here that Paul uses. That in and of ourselves, we are like the centurion. We're unworthy. We're inadequate. We're insufficient on our own. But again, we can be adequate before God. We can be worthy, but not on our own merit. And I just think it's interesting, the difference in the words, and then we're going to talk about how that he goes back to the original word that the Jewish elders used of him, and again says, I'm not worthy. So, again, if you'll continue to read Luke 7 and Matthew 8, then we will continue our study, Lord willing, next week.